The myths, when you tell too many lies, I mean, sometimes kids do this. I may have done it on occasion myself, talking to my parents. And you tell them too many different stories, and the stories start to trip over each other, and then you've had it. Well, this is an example of that. You know, the great myth of the land without people, and then you have the myth of, well, they left because the leaders told them to leave. Well, why do you even have to be talking about why they left if they didn't exist to begin with?
That's Richard Becker, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Richard Becker on myths, empire, and the Middle East. The great historian Howard Zinn always reminded us of the importance of knowing history, not the imagined and fabricated past, but what actually happened. Without that knowledge, we are putty in the hands of manipulators and prevaricators. Powerful states have incentives to invent history, and they have varied instruments at their disposal to achieve their ends. Few areas in the world are as deeply contested as the Middle East, with its strategic location astride Europe and Asia, and its unparalleled oil and natural gas reserves. Britain primarily, and France to a lesser extent, were heavily involved in the geographical shaping of the Middle East. Their imperial decisions reverberate to the present. Today, in the Middle East, the U.S. is the hegemon. Can anyone say imperial power? Blanketing the region not only with new myths, but with its armed camps and naval and air bases. To talk about myths, empire, and the Middle East is Richard Becker. Richard Becker is a writer and commentator on Middle East affairs and has visited the region on numerous occasions. He's the author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. Richard Becker spoke in Taos, New Mexico.
What we have gotten in the United States is a lot of myths that have taken the place of the real history. And I want to talk about what some of those myths are and the reality behind them. And the history is very important. And what makes it important, and perhaps why history is more and more disregarded, is that it's impossible to really understand any contemporary situation outside of its historical context. I just would give one example in a related issue, and that is, you know, for 20 years now, it's two decades, that Iraq has been in the center of U.S. Foreign policy. And as far as I know, throughout that 20 years, no major media in the United States has done a show that has a theme, how did the U.S. get involved in Iraq anyways? You know, it's halfway around the world. And because to talk about that real history is to go somewhere that they don't want to go. It's to go somewhere dangerous. And I'll come back to that in a second. The major myth, and in my book, I freely admit this book is a polemical book. But I would also assert that all books that deal with history are polemical books. Some are openly so, and some are covertly so. But the major myth, I think, is dealt with in how the book begins. 2 days after Barack Obama assumed the presidency, he introduced at the State Department a man named George Mitchell, who many of you know of, former senator, former Northern Ireland negotiator for the United States back in the 1990s. You know, where he said the conflict's been going on for 800 years. Really, the struggle against British colonialism has been going on for hundreds of years. But at this press conference at the State Department, where all the top-level people of the State Department and the media were gathered, Mitchell told a quote-unquote joke, and this is the joke. Just recently, I spoke in Jerusalem, and I mentioned the 800 years. He's referring to Ireland. And afterwards, an elderly gentleman came up to me and said, "Did you say 800 years?" I said, "Yes, 800. He said, "Ah, such a recent argument. No wonder you settled it." Now, all the officials laughed knowingly and the press laughed knowingly because they all, quote unquote, know that the conflict there hasn't been going on for 800 years. The conflict between Arabs and Israelis or Muslims and Jews, it's been going on for thousands of years, back to the beginning of time. And that's been repeated so often that it's the conventional wisdom in the United States. The only problem with that fact is that it's not true. It's a malicious misrepresentation of what's going on. And it's a malicious misrepresentation with the intention of letting someone off the hook. And who is it that they're letting off the hook? This idea is that there is really an irreconcilable conflict between the peoples of the region or peoples of different faiths, and it cannot be resolved. But I assert in the book that there is, in fact, an irreconcilable conflict in the Middle East, but it's not one between different peoples or different faiths. It is instead the struggle between, on the one hand, imperialism, the state of Israel, and the dependent Arab regimes. That's one side, and on the other side are the oppressed peoples of this region, this oil-rich and strategic region, who want what all people want, a decent life, real liberation, real progress. And that at the very heart of the conflict in the Middle East is Palestine. So to take a couple other myths, how did the modern Middle East come into being? Another subject that isn't discussed, they're just off the table. I think most people in the United States would assume those countries that are there, they've always been there, or back to the time of Jesus or Moses or something like that. But that's not true either. The modern Middle East arose out of World War I. And there are two kind of myths about World War I. One, that it was a war to make the world safe for democracy. And the other was that it was a war to end all wars, a theme that was dropped pretty quickly because it was only 20 years until the next even deadlier war. And how deadly was World War I? On the average day of World War I, in the 51 months and a few days that it went on the average day, 6,000 people were killed. That's more than all the U.S. casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan up to present combined. Every single day. And what were they dying for, really? Well, were they dying for democracy? This was a war of empires. On the one side were the British, French, Russian, Italian, Dutch, Belgian, Japanese empires. On the other side were the German, Austro-Hungarian, and Turkish empires. And later, another country came into the war called the United States of America, which wasn't the only one not officially called an empire, but of course, it was an empire and had recently taken the colonies of Spain. And why were the empires fighting with each other? Were they doing it so that they could bring democracy into being in the world? Well, no, of course not. They had divided the world among themselves. 30 years before the beginning of the war in 1914, they met in Berlin, called the Congress of Berlin, and they sat at a table and divided up the rest of Africa. Most of Africa was not colonized at that point, and they divided it among themselves. And that's one of the reasons why if you look at a map of Africa, you'll see a lot of straight lines. It's not because the rivers run real straight or the mountain ranges run real straight. It's because those lines were drawn with rulers, the way that they were in the Middle East as well. Not for the benefit of the people there, of course, and that's a large part of, you know, the problems of Africa down to today is what happened there in Berlin in 1884. But they were drawn for the convenience of the empires as they made these deals among themselves. And having divided the world among themselves, they now fought with each other and redivided the world. And the winners took the colonies of the losers when the war was over. And while the war was going on, a year after it started, a man named T.E. Lawrence was dispatched from London to go to the Middle East and to meet with Arab leaders. All of the Arab countries, the modern Middle East, was then either in actuality or nominally under the control of the Ottoman Empire. And there was the beginnings of the Arab national movement. And met with some kings and other leaders, Lawrence, and said, if you'll fight with us against the Ottoman Empire after the war, we will support your right to have an independent Arab country. And so they did. But at the same time as Lawrence was there making these false promises, the British and French and Russian foreign ministers were meeting in secret and drawing up what became known as the Sykes-Picot Treaty. And the Sykes-Picot Treaty was how they were going to divide the Middle East among themselves. And this is how the modern Middle East actually came into being. And the other big factor in shaping the modern Middle East was the rise of political Zionism. And political Zionism, I'm not talking about religious Zionism. We have no opinion about that in this context at all. Political Zionism, you would have the idea also that this is some kind of an ancient movement. It's not. It really arose in the latter part of the 19th century. The first settlers went in very small numbers in the early 1880s to Palestine from Europe. And it really gained momentum in the 1890s. And what happened in the 1890s? In 1895, there was a trial in France of a man named a lieutenant in the French army named Alfred Dreyfus, who was Jewish. And the high command of the French military whipped up an anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish hysteria in order to convict him, charged him with treason, sent him off to this horrific prison called Devil's Island. And one of the people covering the trial was an Austrian journalist named Theodor Herzl. And Herzl concluded from this trial that it would be necessary for Jewish people to be free to have their own state. And this was to remain a minority opinion in the Jewish community, very distinctly so, in the Jewish community in Europe for up until the time of World War II. The next year after this trial, Theodor Herzl wrote a book called The Jewish State. And the year after that, in 1897, not in ancient history, 113 years ago, there was the first meeting of the World Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland. And the Congress had a debate. Where would they like their state to be? Maybe it could be in Uganda, which was part of the British Empire. Or maybe it could be in Argentina, which was technically independent, but really part of the British Empire still. And they were leaning, though, toward Palestine, which was still part of the Turkish Ottoman Empire. But they didn't know anything about Palestine. So they sent off a delegation to Palestine made up of two rabbis. And the words of the telegram that the rabbis sent back are now the title of a book that came out last year by a Palestinian woman, author, intellectual named Grada Karmi. And this is what the telegram said. The bride is indeed beautiful, but she's married to another man. And what it really was saying was Palestine is a beautiful country, but somebody else lives here. And this is important in regard to yet another myth. And that is a very important foundational myth for the Zionist movement and the State of Israel, which is that Palestine was a land without people for a people without a land. But here, at the first World Zionist Congress, 50 years before the establishment of the State of Israel, it was known to the organizers of the Zionist movement that, in fact, another people did live there. And a few years later, a British survey reported that virtually all arable land in Palestine was already under agricultural use. But there's another side to this that's very important. This did not deter the Zionist organizers at all from their project, because from their point of view, it may have been more that they thought a land without Europeans is a land without people. Now, that's not unique. I want to say that's not unique to the Zionist movement. We should think about the country we are in, because that was the attitude of the settlers, the European settlers, who came to the Americas. They did not regard the indigenous people as really being people. They regarded them as less than people and therefore subject to any kind of oppression. So the Zionist movement had these contradictory characteristics about it. On the one hand, it was a response to anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish racism. But on the other hand, it was a Euro-supremacist, or what we would refer to in the United States as a white supremacist movement. And it was also a colonialist movement. The organizers knew that they, in order to succeed, had to enlist the support of one or other of the empires that completely covered Europe at the time. So they went to the Turkish Empire first, to the Sultan, and offered to help with the troubled finances of the Turkish Empire if they could get support for this project, but after some discussion, that was rejected. Herzl himself went and met with a man named Van Plehve in Russia in 1902. And Van Plehve was known as the minister of pogroms by the Jewish people in the Russian Empire and in the world, because he had orchestrated this most horrific pogrom that had taken place a couple of years earlier. And they tried to make a deal. And, you know, in going to these empires, though, they had to offer something, as they did to the Sultan and to the Russian Empire. They couldn't just go to the empires, the emperors, and say, or their staff and say, we're oppressed people, can you help us? Because the reaction of the empires is, that's our business, is oppressing people. Why would we possibly care or be interested in helping you? There had to be a quid pro quo. Something had to be on offer in exchange. So when they went and met with this Van Plehve, what Herzl offered was, we can divert the revolutionary, young revolutionary Jewish people in the Russian Empire away from the revolutionary movement and will bring them towards Zionism. And von Plehve actually agreed to this. And Herzl got all excited and he went back and told the guy who succeeded him, the other top leader of the Zionist movement at that time, Chaim Weizmann, oh, we've got an agreement with von Plehve. And Weizmann, who had been born in Russia but now lived in Britain, was horrified by this. He said, well, if word of this gets out, we can forget about the movement because the whole Jewish population will consider us to be bankrupt and traitors and so forth. Well, that didn't work out either. Where it worked out, where it would eventually work out, was in with the British Empire. Here was an appeal that I think illustrates a lot about the movement at the time. This was written the year that World War I started. And it was written by Chaim Weizmann. Herzl died in 1904. He succeeded as Chaim Weizmann, who would be around as a leader up until the formation of the State of Israel in 1948 and become the first president of Israel. He wrote a lot of letters to people, talked to a lot of people, did a lot of lobbying. Here's one of his letters, an excerpt. Should Palestine fall within the British sphere of influence, and should Britain encourage Jewish settlement, we could develop the country, bring back civilization to it, and form a very effective guard for the Suez Canal. So there, in just a few words, are the two ideas that I'm talking about expressed. One, we could, quote unquote, bring back civilization to it, as if there wasn't a long-developed civilization that existed there. And so the Euro-supremacist aspect. And then the other side, the quid pro quo, form a very effective guard for the Suez Canal. That promise of probably didn't mean a lot to the British at the time, because the British had the biggest navy in the world, and the Zionists had no navy at all or no military at all. But it expressed the intention of what would later come to fruition. And one other thing about it, about the colonial character, this was no secret. Before World War II, there was quite a bit more openness from the leaders of the Zionist movement, the movement that would lead to the creation of the State of Israel. And Herzl, shortly before he died, when he was trying to get the British support, wrote a letter to Cecil Rhodes. Does everybody know who Cecil Rhodes was? He was the arch architect of British colonialism in Africa, infamous as a racist, and there were two countries named after him that have better names today, Northern Rhodesia and Southern Rhodesia, which are today called Zambia and Zimbabwe. Herzl wrote a letter to Rhodes, and he said, "You are being invited to make history. That cannot frighten you, nor will you laugh at it. It doesn't involve Africa, but a piece of Asia Minor," referring to Palestine. And he says, "How then do I happen to turn to you because it is something colonial?" So very unambiguous about this. And finally, it was in the midst of World War I that the British government issued what a famous declaration called the Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration was from Arthur Balfour. He was then the British Foreign Secretary, in other words, Foreign Minister. And this is what it says in part. His Majesty's government, meaning the British government, view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. So this is what a Palestinian scholar, Dr. Ismail Zaid, said about that. It's interesting to note that the four-letter word Arab occurs not once in this document. To refer to the Arabs who constituted 92% of the population as the non-Jewish communities is not merely preposterous, it's deliberately fraudulent. Palestine did not belong to Balfour to assume such acts of generosity. The British hadn't even really taken over the area yet, and they're already giving part of it away. Well, this became known to the world because of something else that coincidentally happened 5 days later. And that was the Russian Revolution. The new revolutionary government that came into being in Russia, as one of its first tasks, published all the secret treaties that Russia, the Russian Empire, had entered into with the other empires, including the Sykes-Picot Treaty, about how they were going to divide up the Middle East. The Russians were going to get a lot of Turkey. And what the treaty said, what the Sykes-Picot Treaty said, was that the British would get modern-day Palestine, or what was called Palestine, Jordan, and the southern two provinces of Iraq, and the French would get Lebanon and Syria. And so this became known to the people in the Arab world by the fact of this being published by the Russian government, the new revolutionary government. And they also found out around the same time about the Balfour Declaration. So not only had they been betrayed, they had been doubly betrayed from their point of view. The promise of support for an independent state not only was not being met, they were being incorporated into the two biggest empires in the world. That was the intention. And at the very heart of the Arab world, a piece of it was being given away to somebody else, to a European settler movement. In 1919, 6 months after World War I ended, there was a meeting in Damascus, Syria. And it was called the General Syrian Congress. And the delegates came from Palestine, modern-day Palestine, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. And they met together and they declared a new state called Syria. And that would have become a state that would have gone on existing and perhaps expanded because there was a lot of sentiment for one large Arab state. And they said at their meeting after the war, they said they repudiated the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the Balfour Declaration, and the Zionist Project, and said, how can the Zionists go back in history 2,000 years to prove that by their short sojourn in Palestine, they have now a right to claim it and return it as a Jewish home, thus crushing the nationalism of a million Arabs? So this is important because this is how the modern Middle East came into being. This is how the borders of the modern Middle East were drawn. And the modern Middle East would have been a very different Middle East had it not been, and it was in fact not crushed by the Zionist movement, which was too weak at that time. It was crushed by the British and French colonial armies. And you can go today to Damascus and Beirut and you can visit martyr squares in both countries where the people who rose up and rebelled against the entrance of the French army into those two countries to take it over were hung by the French. The rebellion that took place, it took place all over this region. In Iraq, 10,000 Iraqis at least were killed, 2,000 British soldiers, so the fighting was very fierce, including the British commanding general. And in Palestine, the people rose up. And all over the region, and they were only crushed by this imperialist, colonialist military force that would stop at nothing to add them to their empires. One of the things, just to go back to what I started with about history, is that the two southern provinces of Iraq in this deal, this secret deal, were supposed to go to Britain, and the northern province of Iraq, Mosul province, which was the only one where it was known there was oil at the time, was supposed to be go to the French. But while the British and French were collaborating with each other, they were also stabbing each other in the back. So the British army had moved into all of Iraq. It took them several years to solve the problem, to sort it out. And this is how they sorted it out, that the British could keep the northern province of Iraq, but the oil of Iraq would be divided five ways. The British and French oil companies would each get 23.75%. The Dutch, Shell, would get 23.75%. And two U.S. oil companies would get 23.75%, even though there had never been a U.S. soldier in the Middle East during World War I, but they had demanded economic considerations for having come in on the side of the British and the French. And 5% went to a man named Kalous Gulbenkian, an Armenian oil baron who went out, who's known in history as Mr. 5%er. So if you add all those together, what do they add up to? 23.75 times 4 plus 5 equals 100%. That's right. And that's how it was for Iraq. Up until 1958, Iraq had 0% of Iraq's oil. And the foreign oil companies controlled it all until that revolution happened. So that's why that's a dangerous place to go. Because if you ask, how did the United States first get involved in Iraq to begin with? You go right to the heart of the matter. Forget the democracy, the human rights, all of that stuff. It's the oil, and it's control of the world's oil. So over the next 15 years, after the Balfour, 20 years after the Balfour Declaration, the Zionist population in Palestine, I should say that before the Zionist movement, the population of Palestine was about 75 to 80% Muslim, 15 to 20% Christian, about 5% Jewish, all Arabs. And that sounds funny to some people because they're so accustomed to hearing about the Arab-Israeli or Arab-Jewish conflict. But they were all Arabs. Now, and the indigenous Jewish population was completely opposed to the Zionist project, believing that it would poison relations which were relatively good at the time. And, of course, that was absolutely true. Up until the mid-1930s, the Zionist settler population increased to about 30%. And in 1936 to 39, there was a great rebellion among the Palestinians against both British colonialism and against the Zionist project. It started with a six-month general strike. It was followed by 2.5 years of guerrilla warfare that tied down a large part of the British Empire in a very small area. Finally, in 1939, the British succeeded in crushing the rebellion, and many of the Palestinian organizers and leaders and the leading people were killed or imprisoned. And so on the very eve of World War II, 1939, the Palestinians are in a much weakened state. And the Zionist movement has been allowed to develop and its military forces grow. And the British have used them, as well as the King of Jordan, who they'd put in place, against the Palestinians. And so they were stronger. There was a law that said if for a Palestinian who owned a rifle, punishable by hanging. So the Palestinians are in this very weakened state when the war began. And why did the Palestinians, and this is a subject that, you know, some people who claim to be, you know, for justice and peace in the region, I think also misinterpret and say, well, why didn't the Palestinians welcome the Jewish people who came, the settlers who came, because they were suffering oppression too? And it's a misunderstanding of what was going on. And really what the Palestinians understood and what was very clear in the Zionist movement was that the intention was not just to come and live, but it was to come and displace the indigenous population. And in 1940, as World War II is getting underway, this wasn't a big secret. There was a big debate in the Zionist movement. A small minority were for a binational state. They were defeated. And in 1940, Joseph Weitz, who was the director of the Jewish National Land Fund, one of the most important institutions responsible for acquiring land, wrote to other leaders, "Among ourselves, it must be clear that there's no room for both people in this country, and there's no way besides transferring the Arabs from here to neighboring countries to transfer them all." In other words, it was known, the Palestinians understood what the nature of the movement, the same really as the Native American people here came to understand what the settlement movement was about very soon. At first, it wasn't clear, and at first they were, in many cases, welcoming. But it became clear that the intention was to remove the indigenous population altogether.
You're listening to Richard Becker on Myths, Empire, and the Middle East. This is AR. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
I want to talk just a minute about World War II and why the United States supported the creation of the State of Israel. This is another myth. And the myth being that it was either out of guilt or sympathy on the part of the U.S. and British governments that led them to support the partition plan. In fact, I would argue that imperialist politics and sympathy are entirely distinct and mutually exclusive categories. To believe that they care about any people, including us, is to, I believe, labor under an illusion. In 1942, it became clear to the high command in Washington that the death camps were functioning at a high rate of murder, mass murder. Not only mass murder, mechanized mass murder. Millions of Jewish people, two-thirds of the Roma population, millions of Slavic people, communists, socialists, gay people went through these camps. The Jewish population in Europe was especially, and the Roma population, were the ones most, of course, disproportionately affected by the mass murder. But it was mechanized mass murder. And there was an appeal to a number of appeals to the high command in the United States to say, well, if your troops are not going to be in Western Europe soon, you could at least bomb the rail lines and bomb the gas chambers and slow down the mechanized mass murder that is going on. And they absolutely refused to do it. They said it's not strategically efficacious, even though their planes, their bombers on bombing runs were flying over many of the camps. But they refused and showed very little concern about this. I quoted in the book, there was only one Jewish member of the Roosevelt administration. His name was Henry Morgenthau Jr. And he was no radical. He came from Wall Street the way all secretaries of the Treasury always must. And that's who they represent very powerfully in the government. So it's most unusual what he did. He commissioned a group inside the U.S. Treasury Department to study what the United States government was really doing in regard to the mass murder of Jewish people and others in Europe. And in January 1944, the report came out. And here's what the report said from Morgenthau. One of the greatest crimes in history, the slaughter of the Jewish people in Europe is continuing unabated. This government has for a long time maintained that its policy is to work out programs to serve those Jews of Europe who could be saved. I am convinced, on the basis of the information which is available to me, that certain officials in our State Department, which is charged with carrying out this policy, have been guilty not only of gross procrastination and willful failure to act, but even of willful attempts to prevent action from being taken to rescue Jews from Hitler. That's an incredible accusation from a top official of the government to make against other top officials of the government. I can't ever remember saying that. Usually, if you disagree like that, the next day you have to resign. But Morgenthau was in a strong enough position that he stayed. But it shows something. The real reasons, I believe, for the support, and say this in the book, that the surviving population, about 400,000 Jewish people in Europe who wanted to leave and wanted to come to the United States overwhelmingly, the United States government did not want them to come, viewed them as being dangerously radical. And the United States government after World War II was, of course, going in a completely different direction. That was, as part of its new phase of being the world's lone superpower, would be to stamp out, to crush the left inside the United States. The last thing they wanted to do was to bring more people they considered as being leftist to the United States. And there was also a lobby that was supporting, of course, voting for the State of Israel and voting for its creation. So I used a map in the book, showed what happened at that time, but it's a triptych. And it's three. On this side is Palestine, the British Mandate of Palestine, the colony in 1946. And the little dots on it are the Zionist-owned land, owned by the Jewish National Land Fund, which constituted about 6.6% of Palestine. And then the next one over is what the UN partition plan that was voted on only through great U.S. pressure being brought to bear in the General Assembly on November 29th, 1947. And that awarded what would become the State of Israel 55% of Palestine, 44% was supposed to become a Palestinian Arab state, and 1% an international zone around Jerusalem. And then the war took place in 1948, and at the end of it, Israel constituted 78% of historic Palestine, of British Mandate Palestine. Jordan annexed the West Bank, which became the by far most prosperous part of Jordan, and that was part of them having been conspiring with the Zionist leadership. And Gaza came under administration of the State of Egypt, and there was no more Palestine. It was gone, according at least in the maps in the West, not in the maps in the Middle East, but in the West. And I would submit, first of all, that vote at the United Nations was completely illegal. I mean, aren't you supposed to have a plebiscite or a referendum or something among the people in an area? You'd sit, you know, thousands of miles away in New York around a table and, you know, say, okay, this is what's going to happen to you. Although a couple months ago, the NATO defense ministers met in Bratislava, Slovakia, to talk about the future of Afghanistan. So that's not such just an ancient practice. But the vote immediately led to war. And in the war, in the first phase of the war, the Israeli side, Zionist side, which later became in May of 1948, became the State of Israel, Israeli military forces, won most of the battles. And they eventually won the war overwhelmingly. And this is treated in the kind of official history as perhaps a miracle. The supporters of Israel treat it like this, is that And they repeat this over and over. Here was little Israel in a sea of Arabs. They like to use the phrase sea of Arabs a lot. And the implication being that, you know, Israel was much weaker, and how did it win? And maybe it was a miracle, maybe it was divine intervention, you know, something like that. But 35 years after the war, in 1983, there was a 35-year lock and key lock on the security documents at the time. In 83, these documents, or many of them, were released. And today, you can read many, many Israeli as well as Palestinian historians who document what really happened at that time. And one of the things, one of the facts, as opposed to myth, is that at every stage in the war, first between the Palestinians and the Zionists, and then between the State of Israel and the surrounding Arab states, the Israeli side always had superiority in funds, in weaponry, in military organization, and in actual numbers of fighters in the field at every stage in the war. And this is now very well documented. And those Arab states that were supposedly so powerful and surrounding them were all still colonies in either name or in reality. That is, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Jordan. They were all under the control of the domination of the British or the French. And then there's the other myth, a great myth that's very foundational, and that is that the Palestinians who left, and three-quarters of the population, Palestinian population, left. The Zionist myth and is that they left because the Arab leaders told them to leave. And this is supposed to be why you don't have to let them come back. But first of all, that's a completely illogical idea. It was mostly an agricultural society. Try telling farmers, leave for a while, maybe for a few weeks or months, and come back. Everything will be okay. They, of course, can't. I mean, if they have livestock, they have crops, you can't. It's actually impossible to do if you want to continue. But the same documents that were released in 1983 showed that what really caused the Palestinians, three-quarters of the Palestinian population, to leave, 750 to 800,000 people, was terror, massive terror. You can read a book by an Israeli historian that came out last year, I believe it was, Ilan Pape. The title of the book kind of says it all, that is, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. That there was not just the famous massacre at Deir Yassin, there were many, many, many massacres, and that terror was used to evict the population, often taking the men in a village who were considered of fighting age between 14 and 55, shooting them and loading the rest of the population into trucks or marching them, force marching them to the nearest border. That's how three-quarters of the Palestinian population was cleared. And then in the immediate aftermath, more than 500 Palestinian villages were bulldozed to eliminate that memory, or to try to eliminate that memory. The myths, when you tell too many lies, I mean, sometimes kids do this. I may have done it on occasion myself, talking to my parents. And you tell them too many different stories, and the stories start to trip over each other, and then you've had it. Well, this is an example of that. You know, the great myth of the land without people. And then you have the myth of, well, they left because the leaders told them to leave. Well, why do you even have to be talking about why they left if they didn't exist to begin with, right? So these myths, which are all considered very important by Israel, the leaders of Israel and its supporters. But regardless of why they left, in December of 1948, the United Nations passed another resolution called Resolution Number 194, that said all of the refugees had a right to return, they had to be allowed to return, they had to be restored to their property, and they had to be compensated for damages. That has not happened in any cases up until now. And today, there are around 7 million registered Palestinian refugees, because you are legally entitled under international law to register as a refugee, as a descendant of refugees who have not been restored. Another one of the myths is that this is continued a myth down till today, and very important, is that Israel is victim. That is, Israel wants peace, but it cannot find a partner for peace. This is endlessly repeated, and it's completely false. In 1949, I quoted Moshe Dayan, who was then a rising young military officer, a favorite of David Ben-Gurion, the first Israeli prime minister. He was at a cocktail party in Tel Aviv, and he told an American diplomat who reported it back that he had said that the frontier of Israel should be on the Jordan River. Present boundaries ridiculous from all points of view. In other words, the 78% was viewed by the Israeli leadership as temporary. And in fact, it's now been documented, including by right-wing Israeli historians, there's a book about this called The Second Round, is that Israel was seeking what they called the second round in the early 1950s, and that is a new war with Jordan to be able to take over the West Bank. But in order to protect their position in the world, had to make it look like they were retaliating. And retaliation is one of those loaded words. If you can convince other people that you are retaliating, then you are also convincing them that you are the victim, right? You are acting in self-defense. Somebody did something to you before. Finally, in 1967, and this is important too because this is another episode involving the quote-unquote Sea of Arabs, the 1967 war, when Israel then took the remaining 22% of Palestine along with the Golan Heights and the Sinai Peninsula. And in the United States, that too was treated as an act of self-defense, that here the Sea of Arabs, quote-unquote, was surrounding them and was about to annihilate them. And this is what the general, not at the time, of course, they waited a few years to say this, General Matiyahu Peled, who was one of the top Israeli commanders, said 10 years later, told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, "The thesis that the danger of genocide was hanging over us in June 1967 and that Israel was fighting for its physical existence is only a bluff which was born and developed after the war." And Moshe Dayan, who is by now the defense minister, about 20 years after the war, in another interview, he said, "We would send a tractor to plow some area where it wasn't possible to do anything in the demilitarized zone." This is the demilitarized zone that nobody's supposed to go into between Israel and Syria from the 48 war. And he said, "And knew in advance that the Syrians would start to shoot. If they didn't shoot, we would tell the tractor to advance further until in the end the Syrians would get annoyed and shoot. And then we would use artillery and later the Air Force also, and that's how it was." So really, this was the, you know, partner for peace, but can't find, seeking peace, but can't find a partner for peace. That is propaganda, pure and simple. And if we look at the situation today, even in the aftermath of the Oslo Accord, down to the present time, we've seen the unfettered and consistent year in and year out expansion of the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. So now there are 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. Where is, if the people are serious about a two-state solution, always a questionable idea, I think, but where's the second state going to be? And of course, the real intention of the Israeli leaders is to talk nice, especially for our benefit here in the United States, because they can't do all this without the support they get from the United States. To talk nice, but to continue to create what they call facts on the ground, that is seizing more and more territory. Just to say a couple other things, is Israel an apartheid state? Big subject of debate, right? And I wrote about it at the time when Carter's book came out, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. I was glad he wrote the book because it introduced the subject into many more people than would hear about it otherwise. I disagreed with him when he said there was no apartheid inside 1948 for the Palestinians who live there. They can vote, but in every other way, they're third or fourth class citizens. But he got the usual treatment that people who criticize Israel, that he was anti-Semitic. I mean, unless you're Jewish and you criticize Israel, then you're a self-hating Jew. That's the formula. But that formula, I think, is kind of losing some of its punch. And one person, though, who came to his defense, interestingly, was a woman named Shulamit Aloni, who was a former minister of education in Israel. And she wrote a column in the leading newspaper in Israel. And the title of the column was, Indeed, there is apartheid in Israel. And she described the Jewish-only roads in the West Bank. She said, wonderful roads, wide roads, well-paved roads, brightly lit at night. All that on stolen Palestinian land. When a Palestinian drives on such a road, his vehicle is confiscated and he's sent on his way. And she talks about this incident where she witnesses this. She's out on a road in the West Bank. She witnesses this. She pulls over and she asks this Israeli soldier, why is confiscating the Palestinian's car? And the soldier replied, it's an order. This is a Jew's only road. Aloni continued, I inquired as to where was the sign indicating this fact and instructing other drivers not to use it. His answer was nothing short of amazing. The soldier says, it is his responsibility to know it. And besides, what do you want us to do? Put up a sign here and let some anti-Semitic reporter or journalist take a photo so that he can show the world that apartheid exists here? There's also an interesting statement from the South African delegation, but given time, I'm not going to read it. The last point I want to say in here, people who came from, who had been anti-apartheid fighters talking about how they couldn't believe the situation in Palestine, that they said it's more terrible than what we faced. So the last thing I want to touch on is this point. So now here we are in 2010. Where's this going? What's the future here? For the first time since 1948, a couple of years ago, inside what was the British colony of Palestine, the Palestinian Arab, and that's the West Bank, Gaza, and 1948 borders of Israel, the Palestinian Arab population and the Israeli Jewish population are roughly equal. Probably the Palestinian population is greater. If it's not greater today, it will be greater tomorrow. This is a big subject of discussion in Israel. It's called the demographic problem. But it really presents the question. So what are the outcomes? What are the potential outcomes? Well, the one that's talked about very often is the two-state solution, a state for the Palestinians and a state for the Israelis. What has been on offer so far to the Palestinians would not be found acceptable by anybody else in the world as a state. It's the condition is Gaza is supposedly not occupied, but the Israelis control the borders. And the airspace and the water and who comes and who goes and what comes and what goes. It's like saying that a prison has been liberated. If you take all the guards and you put them outside and you cut off anything going in and you surround it with machine guns and say, yeah, but they're all free inside now. Well, it's the same thing as what was offered for the West Bank in 2000. So it's a state that's really a dependency. It's not really a state like anybody else's state. And as far as the West Bank, what's been offered is broken up pieces of territory with the settlements still there, with the Israeli-only roads. And anywhere where the settlements are, so too will be the military. So there's that. Could there be a new mass expulsion like what happened in 1948? Some of the Israeli leaders would like to do it. Avigdor Lieberman, who's only been there for 26 years himself from came from Russia, but tells the Palestinians, take your bundles and go. That's a quote. He would like to do that, but I think that would be pretty hard to do at this point in history. Or Israel could just annex the West Bank, which they're really doing, trying to do step by step. And then in order to preserve Israel as an exclusivist, quote unquote, Jewish state and democracy, which are contradictions in terms, they could create an official apartheid system that disenfranchise the Palestinians. I think that would be pretty hard to do too. The other possibility, of course, the one that's treated as being the most ludicrous idea anyone ever thought of when it's brought up, both in Washington and in Tel Aviv, don't even talk about that. That's so radical. Forget it. You know, is the idea of one state with equal rights for all people, a very, very radical notion, huh? But it's hard to see where this is going other than that eventually. The very last thing I want to say is about the, I started out talking about the irreconcilable conflict. What's the real irreconcilable conflict? And what is it? When we in San Francisco have demonstrations, we always get counter demonstrations and it's the San Francisco Voice for Israel. And people always bring signs, and not just San Francisco, that say, Israel is here to stay. And we say to them, well, Israel is the fourth most powerful military, protected by the first most powerful military, gets huge amounts of aid, so has this high, relatively high standard of living and so forth. Why do you carry signs that say Israel is here to stay? It's not really an expression of security. It's an expression of insecurity. And what's the source of the insecurity? Is that they think that they're about to be overrun by the Arab armies? No way. There's no, the today as back in 1948, there's no comparison, even more so today. Only Israel in the Middle East has nuclear weapons, aside from the United States, which is really in the Middle East too. But it's the only country that has nuclear weapons. They're not going to be defeated by the Palestinians. But there is a threat, a perceived threat. And I want to just close by saying, quoting someone about this threat. And his name is Menachem Begin. And some of you may recall when he was prime minister. He was a terrorist. He proclaimed he was a terrorist. He said, I'm a terrorist in the lead up to the war. And so right-wing and fascistic was Begin that in 1948, after the State of Israel was created, he wanted to come to the United States. He did come to the United States. And there was a full-page ad in the New York Times signed by 300 prominent Jewish people, including Albert Einstein. And it said, don't let Begin in. He's not only a terrorist, he has Nazi tendencies. That's 1948. That's 3 years after the end of the world. You could not make a stronger accusation against someone, particularly inside the Jewish community, than to say they had Nazi tendencies. But despite his history, he went right into the parliament after the creation of Israel and later became prime minister. But while he was still a member of the parliament and the forerunner to what became the Likud party, he went to a kibbutz at one of the Israeli cooperative farms in 1969. And one of the people who was working in the kibbutz used the word Palestine. And this is how Begin responded to him. My friend, take care. When you recognize the concept of Palestine, you demolish your right to live in Ein HaOresh, which is the kibbutz. If this is Palestine and not the land of Israel, then you are conquerors and not tillers of the land. You are invaders. If this is Palestine, then it belongs to a people who lived here before you came. That's Begin. That's the existential threat, not in some lofty philosophical sense, but in the most basic sense of the word existential, that the Palestinians still exist. And because they still exist, their existence as a people and as a people in struggle, because it was their struggle that put the name Palestine back on the map, their existence is what constitutes the threat to Israel and why its supporters carried these signs at demonstrations. That's what I really think is the reality. So I'll close on that note to really end by saying there's not going to be a solution in the Middle East. The slogan, no justice, no peace, applies in the case of Palestine more than almost anywhere you could think of. There's not going to be peace or resolution in the Middle East until there's real justice for the Palestinian people. Thank you.
That was Richard Becker on Myths, Empire, and the Middle East. He spoke in Taos, New Mexico. Richard Becker is a writer and commentator on Middle East affairs and author of Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Lester Brown, Chris Hedges, Rami Khoury, Robert Fisk, Noam Chomsky, and Arundhati Roy. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR so you don't miss a single program, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Richard Becker on Myths, Empire, and the Middle East, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. And remember to support the station that airs this program. Special thanks to Cultural Energy in Taos. Series theme music is by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with oud maestro Hamza al-Din performing Sunset.